Today. 2 hours of news, current affairs, and opinion, with in-depth panel discussions on domestic and global issues. Today brings you the story behind the headlines. Locally produced, but with a distinctly international flavor. Today.
Welcome to Today, a news program from a different perspective. I'm Brian Kopczynski.
And I'm Liu Kun. On today's show, we're talking about Chinese President Xi Jinping's state visit to the United States.
This is President Xi's first state visit to the country, and it'll be complete with all the works. The pomp and ceremony will come tomorrow, while the two presidents share an informal meeting as we speak. The trip comes at a time of increased tension between the two sides. A single visit cannot solve such a major concern, yet frank dialogue can go a long way towards greater understanding of each other. With the issues not getting any easier, this is something the two governments could certainly use. So what are the main points of discussion to tackle? What results can we hope for? And where do relations between the world's most important countries stand? These questions and more on this edition of Today, where we discuss Xi Jinping's trip to the U.S.
Today we have on the phone with us Helga Zeppler-Rusch, founder of the Schiller Institute in Washington. Also on the phone, Mark Beeson, professor of international politics, political science, and international relations from the University of Western Australia. We also have in the studio Taowen Zhao, senior research fellow of Institute of American Studies at Chinese Academy of Social Science. And also in the studio we have Rick Dunham, co-director of Global Business Journalism program at Tsinghua University. Good morning and good noon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hello.
Good to be here.
Well, to start our conversation here today, I want to ask something about Xi Jinping's speech in Seattle, and that's the only speech during this whole trip. His speech upon arriving in Seattle was peppered with U.S. cultural references, including the film Sleepless in Seattle and the television series House of Cards. He also shared some personal experiences, like his life in the countryside as a young man. So, Rick, you are from the United States. So do you think this personal touches went down well with his American audiences?
Well, I think it's always good to drop a few cultural references when you're in the United States, although I will say House of Cards, I think, is more popular in China than it is in the United States. I mean, everyone at Tsinghua, where I work in Global Business Journalism program, wants to know if it's an accurate depiction of America. More seriously, I think what President Xi Jinping did was to connect with his business audience. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that was more than the American public. His audience there was the CEOs of the tech companies and the aerospace industries and the social media companies. And I think that's he did connect both publicly, and then he did have private meeting and a private roundtable. I think that was more important than his speech.
Well, talking about something else, over the history since China and U.S. established diplomatic ties several decades ago, only four state visits to the U.S. Were paid by Chinese presidents. Li Xianyan in 1985, Jiang Zemin in 1997, Hu Jintao's 2006 contentious visit, and 2011. We now have the fifth here. So how different is this one, Professor Beeson? What do you think has changed, and what do you think remains the same in bilateral relations?
Well, I think the big point to make about the relationship between the United States and China is that over the last decade or two, China's become much more important and everybody has to take it tremendously seriously. So I think the kind of balance of power, if you like, between the two countries has changed somewhat, and China's significance has changed in the international system. And I think one of the clear things that China would like to achieve, or Xi Jinping would like to achieve, is some recognition of this. And I think the whole idea that there's going to be a lot of pomp and ceremony and recognition of China's status in this trip is a very important part of the atmospherics that will accompany it. So there's at least two things going on. I think one is going to be about the kinds of discussions about detail, which we'll undoubtedly discuss in more detail ourselves. But the other, I think, is about the atmospherics of the whole trip and the way that China's treated, and the recognition on the part of America about its increasing status, I think, will be a very important part of what goes on.
And Professor Tao, in addition to that, what do you think really makes the two sides really like each other or feel good about each other versus what might turn them apart?
Yeah, well, since the beginning of this century, the frequent meeting between the
leaders of the two countries has become a regular thing. You know, whenever there's an international conference like an APEC summit, G20 summit, East Asian summit, etc., or nuclear summit,
mm-hmm.
Whenever there are international events, the two leaders always have a formal meeting on the sideline.
Mm.
So sometimes the two leaders meet three or four times in a year, but the state visit is different. For the state visit, the two sides have to make a lot of preparations. You know, since the beginning of this year, I think both China and the United States have been making preparation for this visit. And this year, the strategic and economic dialogue, its major purpose is to make preparation for President Xi's visit. And the U.S. sent several times many high-level officials, including Susan Rice, National Security Advisor, David Scheer, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, and other officials to visit China to make preparation. And China also sent a lot of high-level officials to visit the U.S. So they have prepared a basket of products. You know, from China to the United States, yes, we have something to propose. Mm-hmm. And from United States to China, vice versa. So we can expect a lot of frequency from President Xi's state visit.
Well, it certainly has been a long time coming here, and obviously a lot of preparation going on there. But Ms. LaRouche, aside from the political rhetoric and other things that go on in the media, what do you think that really makes the two political giants like each other, and what kind of turns them apart?
Well, I think that obviously it is extremely important that the two most important countries in the world in terms of size and power, that they have a stable relationship. And I think, you know, the better part of the United States is looking at China from that standpoint. And I think on the side of Xi Jinping, he has made it very clear that he wants to open up with the win-win policy. However, I think that there is a big disparity, which, you know, I hope they will be able to somehow overcome. They are meeting right now as we are talking here in a eye-to-eye discussion, I think, without any other people there. So I would hope that this leads to some breakthrough. However, I really think that there is a big disparity in right now in the way how the two countries go about things. Xi Jinping has offered a completely new model of cooperation among states with the win-win cooperation and the model of the two of the major power relationship, while the United States still tends to cling to the unipolar world outlook, which naturally has a lot of potential for conflict. So I think that the problem right now, why they wouldn't like each other, is that that, you know, they have two models of how to operate in the world at this moment. And, you know, one can only hope that the win-win perspective is so attractive that the United States would recognize that it would be in its own interest to cooperate.
Well, there certainly are different modes of thought going on there, and hopefully this meeting will do something to bridge the gap a little bit. But Professor Dunham, would you say there's anything special about the personal relationship between these two leaders? I mean, we've seen them, you know, they had that big informal meeting at the Sunnylands Ranch in 2013 and took a nice stroll here in Beijing last year. So is there anything special going on there?
Well, I think they definitely connect on an intellectual level. I mean, they've had philosophical as well as political discussions in private. It's clear from their body language when they're together that they like each other, that they respect each other. It's not quite the same as when you see President Obama and Russian President Putin together.
Yeah,
you can tell
there's
bad body language there. So it's good. It's good when the leaders connect. They may not be best friends, but I think that they trust each other and that they enjoy talking about similarities and differences.
Well, that's certainly a good thing there. And it's
at one point, according to Ben Rhodes, Obama's deputy national security advisor, President Obama likes informal talks with President Xi very much, such as in Sunnylands, you know, they talked over dinner for about 2 hours. And the two leaders also take a stroll during the morning. Mm-hmm. Only the two leaders with two interpreters, of course.
Naturally.
And last year, you know, in Yingtai, Xi Jinping also again invited Obama to have a stroll, and they had a Yingtai
Yehua,
you know, for several hours. And it left a very deep impression with President Obama, and actually deepened his understanding of China and of Xi Jinping's policy. And this time, they also have such a chance because, you know, I think exactly probably at this time, Xi Jinping and President Obama and just a few officials with Kerry, with Susan Rice, with Yang Jiechi and Wang Yi, just six people are having dinner.
Right.
And that is a very small circumstance. And probably dinner will last a few hours. And at that dinner, President Xi and President Obama can have an in-depth discussion about the most sensible issues between the two countries.
Right. We can certainly hope so. I guess the longer the dinner goes, the better that is, perhaps.
And hopefully, I mean, the smaller the crowd, the more efficient the meeting will be. But before we move on to talk about the conditions that are straining the relations between the two, Rick, I still want to ask how about the domestic political climate in the United States for this visit?
Well, there are two things that are important there to think of. One is in the Republican primary, almost all the attention has been there because there are 15 candidates, and China bashing is popular. The last Republican debate, you had some of the leading candidates, and the leading candidate in the polling, Donald Trump, repeatedly bashes China. So the context of this is that China is a target in the political sphere, and Barack Obama is trying to keep the focus on the issues and the common interests between the two countries. The other is that the Pope is in the United States right now, Pope Francis, and a lot of American newspapers and American television have been focused on that. So in some ways, I think that that is a benefit for President Xi Jinping and President Obama because they're not high expectations in the United States. And I think if they come up with some concrete agreements, it could end up being very good publicity and be positive for the relationship.
Well, I think I've looked into some headlines of the major U.S. media outlets, right. And only USA Today has a headline for Xi Jinping's visit,
right.
As you have said.
Oh, may I add something?
Yeah, sure.
You know, I think the atmosphere in the United States for Sino-American relations is not very good, frankly speaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems to me that another debate on U.S. policy is going on.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Some people proposed such an article or report as revising U.S. policy towards China. And they even say that the engagement policy since President Nixon to China has been failed. And this emphasizes so-called containing China, or some people do not use that word contain, but strengthening the balance and checking China's rise
while
decreasing the cooperation.
Yeah, certainly there's a lot of rhetoric like that going on, and we will come to that discussion a little bit later. But talking about the timing of this visit, it happens at a time when geopolitical conditions in East Asia has evolved to a very subtle point. As Professor Tao has already said, the Obama administration declared the pivot to Asia diplomacy in 2012, and also tension in the region have been growing with Shinzo Abe seeking to expand Japan's overseas military role, and several Southeast Asian nations have been embroiling themselves into a territorial dispute with Beijing. So, Professor Beeson, How do you comment on the timing of the trip? Is it too limited chemistry and too tough a time?
Well, I think in some ways it's an ideal time for Xi Jinping to be going, if we take the idea seriously that a dialogue between leaders can actually make a significant difference, and the personal chemistry really makes a difference to the outcome of the talks. Mm. I think there are grounds for being skeptical about that possibility, of course, because for both countries, they have long-term agendas and conceptions of themselves as great powers and a particular role in the Asia-Pacific region. And there's a fundamental potential conflict between the two, not necessarily in a military sense, but in terms of their kind of respective grand strategies. And I think whether those goals are compatible, whether the two countries will be able to come to some sort of an agreement about how they manage their relationships, because they are incredibly complicated. And for America in particular, has a strategic alliance with Japan and indeed my own country, Australia, as well. And that places constraints and expectations on what Barack Obama can do. So not only is he constrained by the kind of domestic political realities that Rick was talking about, but he also has wider obligations and expectations by a number of countries in the region, Southeast Asia, Japan, about how the United States will behave and about how it will stand up to what's perceived to be the fairly assertive foreign policy of China in the region. So I think whether they can actually manage those very different expectations and goals that both countries have is going to be one of the big tests of this meeting, I think.
Being tough can also be like a really good timing too. Helga, so how do you think China fit into the current global strategy of the United States and vice versa?
Well, you know, I think that the various proposals coming from China, which I think are very much based on the Confucian conception that the world can only function if it's based on a harmonious relation among nations, is really the key. This is expressed in Xi Jinping's offer of a win-win cooperation, or, you know, to actually, he invited President Obama at the recent APEC meeting last year to cooperate with China in the New Silk Road, in the One Road, One Belt policy. And, you know, that is together with the idea of having a new model among major nations. It's a completely different conception of how to organize international relations among nations based on sovereignty, mutual respect, and recognition of the difference of the social system. Now, I think that that is a model which is right now very attractive. It is, has been adopted by the BRICS countries. It's reaching out to not only ASEAN, but also Latin American countries who enjoy that kind of win-win cooperation with China.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, from the Chinese standpoint, you know, the biggest problem and hope at the same time would be that the United States responds to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the offer to the United States still is on the table. I think various Chinese media have repeated that that offer, that, you know, the Europeans and the United States should cooperate. I could only hope that the United States, which is in a deep trouble right now. I mean, their financial system is in terrible shape. There are many people who say that it's worse than 2008, that you could have a major blowout of the financial system any moment. And the only way how the United States would get out of it is if they would see the chance which lies in that offer. So I think that on the United States right now, you have a big divide. You have some people who see that it would be absolutely in the interest of the United States to cooperate, and you have some others who say, no, we should insist that we are the only leader in the world, Russia is only a regional power, China must be contained, and even the former, still Chief of Staff Dempsey has warned repeatedly that the United States should not walk into the so-called Thucydides trap, seeing a danger in the rise of China by trying to go to war. So if the Joint Chief of Staff is warning of that, you know, it must have a good reason.
Mm. Well, Rick, how do you respond to that? How do you think China fit into the global strategy of the United States?
Well, I think in the next 10 years, we'll see whether for the cross-Pacific relationship, we develop a relationship like U.S. and Great Britain, or the U.S. and Russia. I mean, I think that those are the extremes, and I think partnership is the key. And it's a little bit of, I mean, it concerns me a bit. The United States decided not to take part in the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. That it is pushing this competing idea, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Where the best answer would be some sort of a merger of the two ideas and growth that would benefit everyone. I mean, I think a lot of this boils down to Northeast Asia regional issues involving Japan and Korea. And I think if there is a way to bring those countries together and figure out a way that China and Japan could coexist better, it would also help the United States in the geopolitical way, where it wouldn't have to choose Japan or China.
Yeah, certainly complex issues there with the after effects of World War II. But moving on to another thing, another issue there is China has been quite active in recent years on a number of fronts, political, economic, and elsewhere. And China has still managed to maintain a pretty hefty GDP growth of 7% over recent years and is now the world's second largest economy right after the U.S. And after Xi Jinping came to power, China proposed, like you just mentioned, Professor Dunham, the AIIB, the New Development Bank for BRICS, and the Land and Maritime Silk Road Initiative, and various sorts of things like this. So certainly kind of changing its role in international affairs. So Professor Tao, what would you say these new changes and overall the rise of China means to the United States?
Well, I would say the two aspects. First aspect, China's independent policy independent foreign policy for peace has not yet changed. You know, China will continue to stick to the peaceful development road. China will decide its attitude towards each particular case according to its merits or demerits. China will not use the social system and ideology to decide whether a country should be friends or enemy, etc. And China will continue to open up its doors, of course. This aspect has not yet changed. But on the other aspect, China has become larger, bigger, stronger, number two economy in the world. So as Westerners say, with power comes responsibility. So today, China has more responsibility to provide common goods for this region as well as for the international society. And what you mentioned, the AIIB and the BRICS Development Bank and One Belt and One Road, those are kind of things that China try to provide common goods for the international society. And for China itself, you know, we have reached such a development stage that our technology, our power, and our capital have to go out. You know, we have to develop China's economic, trade, technological relationship with outside further and further. So I think it's very positive. And actually, many Americans, including, for instance, Dr. Kissinger, including Bob Zelick, the former World Bank chief, they all welcome AIIB, think that this is a very good mechanism. So they all criticize the Obama administration for not joining the AIIB and even put pressure on some allies not to join. But actually, you know, Britain, Germany, a lot of Korea, they all joined AIIB and more countries. Today, it's 57 members,
but more
countries are waiting for join that.
Yeah, that certainly was an interesting episode there for the U.S. government there. But Professor Dunham, what's your take on that? What would you say that the rise of China means for the United States?
Well, it's both competition and a chance for cooperation. I think in terms of the geopolitical, the rise of China is important in that, as we were just talking about, with power comes responsibility. And the United States, I think, is expecting China to help in some of the hot spots in the world, from Korea to the Middle East, and being a constructive and an important player working with multilateral institutions. But in terms of you have economic competition between the two countries, and right now I think the biggest problem is, as we alluded to before, United States' relationship with Japan. I think that the two sides have to figure out a way. There's interdependence economically, and both nations' economic success are important for the global economy now, mm-hmm. So they have to figure out a way to work together economically as they compete.
Well, yeah, I think that's probably, up till now, that's probably the best way to deal with it. But before we go to a short break here, I still have a question for Professor Mark Beeson. Conflicting interests of the two countries have been straining their relations, as we have discussed, the issues like the territorial disputes in South China Sea and also cyber security problems we are going to come to later. So how do you think, how big is the damaging effect of this conflict between the two to the relations compared to the need of a further cooperation between two of the world's most influential countries?
Well, I think it's the same dilemma that faces many countries in their relationships, that there are important national interests and goals that all countries feel that they want to pursue, and the question is whether they're compatible with the kind of views and interests that other countries have. And it's particularly acute when the two countries are the most powerful countries in the world, of course. And I think one of the things about the AIIB and the things the other commentators were talking about before is, I think as far as China's concerned, there's a fundamental dissatisfaction with the existing international order, which is seen to be, rightly or wrongly, still dominated by the United States. And as far as the United States is concerned, they see the rise of China as something of a threat to their hegemonic position in the international system. So there are some fundamental challenges in trying to resolve those potentially incompatible views and goals of the two principal countries that we're interested in today.
Mm. Well, we'll take a quick break now, but stay with us as we come back to talk about the economic side of the relationship.
How many people travel between China and the United States each year? More than 4 million. Most of these travelers can benefit from the new reciprocal visa deal agreed by the two countries in November 2014. Secretary of State John Kerry personally issued the first batch of 10-year visas at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing.
This will pay huge dividends for American and Chinese citizens, and it will strengthen both of our economies.
Meanwhile, at the Chinese Embassy in Washington, D.C., Yale University researcher Edmund Downey became the first American to receive a 10-year Chinese visa.
It really makes things simpler, and I think it's a really good step for good cooperation between the two countries.
By 2021, up to 7.3 million Chinese travelers will visit the U.S., making an annual contribution of $85 billion U.S. dollars to the economy. Leave us a comment on Facebook at China Plus News, and you could win a prize from Beijing's Forbidden City.
You're listening to Today with News and Analysis. I'm Liu Kun. Today we're talking about Chinese President Xi Jinping's state visit to the U.S.
And I'm Brian Kopczynski.
To continue our discussion here, we want to take a look at the economic side of the trip. And Helger, we all know that several economic deals are being announced this week during this visit, including like deals with companies such as Boeing and Cisco. So, can economic and trade links still function as the main stabilizer of the overall China-U.S. relations, which Chinese President Xi Jinping has described as the bedrock of international peace and security? What do you think?
Absolutely, yes. I think if there are strong economic ties, then that is a way of overcoming the present tensions. And from all the deals, I would like to emphasize one, and that is that they have now, China and the United States have now agreed to build a fast train from Los Angeles to Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. Now, that may not be my most preferable route, you know, because it's going to a casino, but I think the fact that China is providing its very, very advanced technology of fast trains, I think China has built by now 18,000 kilometers of fast train inside China or something very close to that figure. And these trains are of an excellent quality. And as everybody who has traveled in the United States knows, the infrastructure in the United States needs urgent improvement, you know, both the roads, there is no functioning train system. So, you know, I have proposed since quite some time that if the United States would take up the offer of the win-win cooperation, you know, there could be a cooperation in developing a fast train system for the entire United States. Why not build maglev and other fast train systems from the West Coast to the East Coast and in the population centers in various places like in the East Coast, which would be much superior to airplanes, you know. So I think that if the United States would just say to join the One Road, One Belt, One Road policy or the new Silk Road Initiative, it would mean that also the United States could be rebuilt, which I think is really very, very urgent. So I think that road is the way to go.
One thing I'm pretty sure is that the residents in Los Angeles will be pretty happy about that new railway there. Professor Beeson, what do you think? Like, how do you think the economic and trade links between the two big countries will benefit the rest of the world?
They may well benefit the rest of the world. I think the really significant aspect is their mutual interdependence. And I think there's a very strong evidence to suggest that greater economic integration is a good thing in many ways, not only for economic development, but in helping to stabilize and pacify the relationship. So in principle, it's a good thing. However, when you kind of drill down into some of the specifics and how the relationship actually works sometimes at a bilateral level, it's full of paradoxes, and the fact that China recycles much of the money that it derives from the trade relationship from the United States back into American treasury bonds, and that the American government relies on China to underwrite its domestic debts and spending regime. I mean, these are interesting and paradoxical aspects of the relationship, and the good thing is that both countries are interdependent and reliant on each other. But that's also the bad thing in some ways as well, because I think Chinese leaders recognize that they're vulnerable to shifts in American domestic economic policy. Everybody's very reliant on what the Federal Reserve does as far as interest rates are concerned. The Americans are concerned about access to Chinese markets and so-called currency manipulation by the Chinese. So there are a lot of different aspects to this bilateral economic relationship, which is undoubtedly a good thing in itself and in principle, but some of the finer details, some of the complexities of actually managing that relationship on a day-to-day basis and overcoming the domestic sensitivities that grow up around that relationship when people are concerned about protectionism and dominance and those kinds of things, it makes what is a good thing quite tricky to manage on a day-to-day basis, I think.
It certainly does there. Excuse me. While talking more about that, the chief economist of Moody's Analytics has calculated that for every 1% point drop in Chinese growth, you'll see a corresponding 0.2% reduction in U.S. economic growth, which is equal to about the price of oil going down by $20 a barrel. So, Professor Dunham, how much of an impact would you say the recent downturn or downward movement in the Chinese economy has had on the United States?
It definitely has had an impact, and I agree with Moody's. So, of course, Chinese people are hurt more than the American people by any slump in the Chinese economy. But there is a ripple effect, just like this estimate for 1% drop in Chinese growth, U.S. economic growth drops by 0.2%. It's 20% of the hurt in China, but it still is something. And I think that it will have an impact on the whole interdependent world. I mean, the U.S. and the Chinese economies are both very important to the whole world, and slumps in the two countries, both in terms of demand and in terms of the Chinese demand for raw materials from Africa and other parts of the world, could have a ripple effect. I think Africa, East Asian economies, and the Central Asian economies are most at risk if there is a downturn in China.
Mm-hmm. No, that certainly is no longer a single country concern, but a world concern there. But Professor Beeson, China's been on a path towards reforming its economy, as we've been hearing about over the last couple of years. How important would you say China's economic reforms are to the U.S. economy and the rest of the world?
Well, they're vital at a number of levels. I think at one level, it's interesting that the people talk about a China model as a way of describing the Chinese economy and the fact that it's very different and distinctive to the American model, which is associated with liberalism and free markets. And I think one of the big challenges for China at a number of levels, particularly domestically, is how well they can actually manage what is essentially a very successful capitalist economy at the moment, even though it's not always described that way. And I think some of the things that the Chinese government has been doing domestically to try to cope with fluctuations in the stock market, outward investment flows, those kinds of things, it's a really big test of the ability of the Chinese government to be able to manage the economy. And so far, there's been the whole Chinese story has been one of incredible success and expansion in an unparalleled and historically unprecedented way. But I think what we may be seeing at the moment is the first crisis of capitalism under the management of the Communist Party in China. And this will be a really big test at a number of levels, not the least of which might be ideologically and actually explaining it to the Chinese people, because the one thing that really distinguishes American capitalism, perhaps, is that they're kind of used to the occasional crisis and that people may not like it, but there's an expectation that that's what happens and the market will eventually sort it out. I don't think that kind of thinking and that kind of perspective on the way that capitalist economies work has really become embedded in China in a significant way, and that some of the people who may be damaged by what's going on in China at the moment, it could cause social instability and a real rethinking about quite how they're managing the economy going forward.
But I would like to comment on that briefly, because I think there is a big difference, because the U.S. Economy is mainly asset-driven. I mean, it's very much, you know, Wall Street. It's very much monetarist values, while the Chinese economy has, in the last, for the most part, is based on real economy. It has an incredible industrial core. It has, you know, now engaged in many projects around the world in cooperation with many countries. So even if there was a little problem with the stock market in China, I think it is much less significant. The reality is Wall Street is absolutely bankrupt, and that's a big fundamental difference. The real economy in the United States is in terrible condition. So I would not compare these two economies in that way, because I think when it comes to the real economy, China is in a much, much better condition, and the fact that it has started to branch out to many parts of the world, you know, gives much more substance to the validity of the Chinese economy. I just would like to make that distinction.
Well, I think a lot of these problems, as well, both of our guests have pointed out, will depend on like how the Chinese government will react to this. But one of the reactions they made lately is the moves last month on the value of the renminbi. So, Professor Tao, how much of an issue is that in the relationship now? And if it is was allowed to rise with the market, how do you think it will be received by the United States?
The price of the renminbi has been one of the major issues between China and the United States since, I think, the end of the last century. And we know that in July 2005, Chinese government launched a reform on renminbi's exchange rates. Renminbi did not peg just on the United States, but pegged on a basket of currencies, including U.S. dollars, Japanese yen, euro, and British pound, and also Singapore currency, etc. And we let renminbi to fluctuate by 0.223%. Since then, until the beginning of the financial crisis in 2008, renminbi appreciated vis-a-vis U.S. dollars by 30%. And because of a financial crisis, we again pegged the renminbi to U.S. dollars. And after 2011, we again began the reform of IMB. Now, many international observers think the present renminbi price is reasonable. But of course, it's a very complicated problem how to judge whether it's overvalued or undervalued or just right. But not, anyway, Chinese government is taking measures to later the renminbi be reformed and let renminbi's value be based on the market. And I think this is this process is going on. And at last, RMB has to be convertible. And this is actually one of the conditions the United States or developed countries can recognize China's market status economy.
Well, Rick, how do you think of that? And how do you think the U.S. has been receiving that signal?
Well, the political system is a little bit out of date in the United States. And I think a lot of the political debate in the United States thinks that we're still in 1999. I mean, when China did devalue recently, you had both Republicans and Democrats in Congress saying that China is trying to manipulate its currency to get a trade advantage, where almost all economists, global economic experts, were saying that this was afloat and that this was an adjustment based on the state of the Chinese economy right now. So I think there's a slight disconnect where Republican candidates for president and members of Congress in both parties are still talking like it's 1999, even though the world has moved on to 2015.
I think the Chinese government has actually been doing a lot within their the limit of their capacity to let the renminbi to fluctuate with the market. And I think another issue related to the trade and economic tie between the two country is that a lot of foreign companies, including American companies, have been arguing that they have been faced with some kind of problems in China in terms of market access, national security and cybersecurity laws, and also potential requirements to hand over corporate security materials. Professor Beeson, also, Chinese tech companies like Huawei faces similar problems in the United States. What do you think can be done to this?
Well, I think we have to face the reality that all countries spy on other countries, and some countries are better at it than others. And perhaps one of the concerns in America is that the Chinese might be particularly good at spying on other countries and may be able to use state-owned enterprises as part of this process. And whether that perception is accurate or not, I can't really say. But, I mean, the fact that that perception exists is an interesting part of the way that these kind of discussions will unfold. And there is, amongst many Western governments, there's great suspicion of the relationship between the Chinese state and powerful state-owned enterprises. And I think this is one of the things that fuels concerns about cybersecurity and those kinds of issues. But it's also worth mentioning in the context of the earlier discussion about the manipulation or not of the currency, that it presents a particular challenge for the Chinese government, of course, their relationship with state-owned enterprises, because whenever you have big policy changes in any country, such as fixing the exchange rate at one value or another, it always creates winners or losers. And there are some people in the Chinese economy and some people in the American economy who would welcome particular policy initiatives and changes, and there would be some people that lose by that. And I think we have to recognize that neither China nor the United States are monolithic economies in that respect, and there will be divergent and frequently competing interests at a domestic level that will not all be happy about every policy initiative that's being made. So I think that provides a kind of background set of considerations for the kind of discussions that are happening at the moment.
Well, Professor Tao, what's your take on this?
Yes, I think both China and the United States are undergoing economic reform. For China, of course, we have been in reform for more than 30 years, and now we are going to adjust the economic structure including the financial structure, etc. And at the party's 18th Party Congress, we have advocated a lot of reform measures. And this year also, the State Council advanced many reform measures. But in the United States, reform is also going on. And President Obama announced the so-called revitalization of American manufacturing and also inner sourcing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, President Obama wants to develop U.S. Manufacturing industries, and also to renovate American's infrastructure, as Mrs. LaRouche just mentioned. Yeah, people who visit United States all feel that the U.S. infrastructure, sometimes the railway road is too slow, train is too slow, and sometimes the highway is not in very good condition, etc. So both countries are under reform, and I think both countries should help each other to achieve success in its economic reform, because economic development, as Moody predicted, is to both countries' concern and interests. And I want to add one point, as we discussed earlier about trade and economic relations between the two countries. I think it will remain a stabilizer for the whole overall relationship between China and the United States, and not just stabilizer, it will still be a propeller of our relationship. You know, in the past decades, actually, the trade relationship between China and the United States developed very, very fast, from about 100 billion, billion U.S. dollars at the beginning of the century to 555 billion U.S. dollars last year. Yeah, it's really tremendous. But trade, I think, it's a lower level economic interdependence. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Trade is only about selling and buying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now our economic relations should enter a new stage. That is, relationship will be motivated both by trade and investment. Mm-hmm. Investment is different from trade. Yeah. So now we are negotiating BIT. If BIT can be concluded, for instance, within Obama administration, and then I think China's investment in the United States, as well as U.S. investment in China, will increase tremendously. And that will really boost the both countries' economy as well economic relations.
Mm. Mm, well, certainly opening up both countries' markets to each other would be a very good thing for the economies there. But we'll take a quick break now and stay with us as we come back to wrap up our discussion.
You are listening to newsplusradio.cn.
To get the latest news about China, listen to our entertaining programs, and find out more about Chinese culture, check out our official website.
Our website address is newsplusradio.cn.
CRI, your bridge to China and the world.
You're listening to Today with News and Analysis. I'm Liu Kun. Today we're talking about Chinese President Xi Jinping's state visit to the U.S.
And I'm Brian Kopczynski. Our show is also available on podcast, so if you want to get a hold of us, please search for World News Analysis.
Well, back to our discussion here. Before we wrap up, I want to touch upon several other issues that's central to the relations now. Helge, the run-up to Xi Jinping's visit has been overshadowed by arguments on both sides over cybersecurity. How do you think both leaders should approach this problem?
Well, I think there is a lot of hypocrisy in this discussion because, you know, I mean, the whole world is really upset about the NSA spying on everybody, on citizens, on industries. There, in Europe, there is a big concern that the NSA intelligence gathering in this way did not just help to monitor the private lives of people, but also that it involved industrial spying. I mean, there were articles in the European press where, you know, industrialists were really expressing this concern. So I think we should not be hypocritical in this discussion. It is a fact that the technology has developed that probably all major countries are doing this, and I think nobody should blame the other one for doing something. They're sitting in a glass house themselves and should not throw stones. I think it is important that we move to a new understanding that we have to guarantee the privacy of the person, that we have to respect the intellectual property of patents, and we have to have a treaty. But I think this is just one aspect. I think the world is in such a grave danger right now. You know, we potentially could end up in a big confrontation over Ukraine, over the Middle East, over, you know, the whole situation with terrorism. So I think we need a new international security architecture which is all-inclusive. And I think the question of cybersecurity should be one integral part of that.
Well, it certainly is an important one there. But talking about another issue in U.S.-China relations, one of China's most wanted economic fugitives, Yang Jinyun, was returned to the country last week by the United States. And this is the first time China has succeeded and repatriated a wanted corruption suspect from the U.S. Because the countries don't actually have a extradition treaty, at least at the moment. So, Professor Tao, would you say this signals the U.S. is going to be more willing to help China in its fight against corrupt officials?
Yeah. I think the United States certainly is willing to cooperate with China in anti-corruption. But I saw clearly this case as an express of a goodwill before President Xi Jinping's state visit, mm-hmm. because there's no treaty of a repatriation between China and the United States. Mm-hmm. So U.S. will decide each case, still case by case. Mm-hmm. It's not just the president in the future.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Dunham, would you say that this repatriation is an important next step, or is this more, as Professor Tao just said, more of just an olive branch for this particular visit?
I think it's both. I think it's symbolic. I think it's an olive branch, the timing of it. But there have been a series of concrete actions in the United States by the U.S. Justice Department since the meeting last year in Beijing of the two leaders, of President Xi Jinping and President Obama. And the U.S. has shown a willingness to help China deal with individuals in corruption-related cases. Where they haven't is what they would consider political cases.
No, that's certainly correct.
Yeah, well, I hope we do have more time. But before we wrap up today's show, I want to ask everyone here a very brief question. What do you think can be most expected to be accomplished during this trip between the two leaders? Let's start with Ms. LaRouche, very briefly.
Well, I have written an appeal to the political leaders who will address the UN General Assembly in the next days, that they should not miss out this possibly last opportunity to create a new paradigm for the world, because, you know, we have so many problems. We have the danger of a financial blowout. We have the danger of war, terrorism, mm-hmm. Refugee crisis in Europe, which is really getting out of control. So I think we need to move to a new era of civilization.
Certainly, that would be one of the things everybody, I think, must be looking forward
and
to.
And I think the win-win offer of President Xi Jinping is the best model on the agenda for that.
Mm. Well, Professor Beeson, what's your take?
It would be wonderful if some form of cooperation could be institutionalized on a continuing basis that would give some real consistency to the relationship. I think the big hope for both countries might be to make some progress on climate change, because mm-hmm. it's sufficiently distant that they wouldn't be personally responsible for doing too much about it in the immediate short term, but it would give a real good mm-hmm. progressive sense to the ongoing negotiations. Perhaps that's the best hope.
Yeah. Rick?
I'd say an agreement with rules on the road for cybersecurity to sort of, if they don't have a treaty, at least the first step toward that bilateral investment agreement to move forward and not just to keep talking about it.
Yeah.
Some sort of agreement on terrorism and the international cooperation there. And then finally, what Professor Beeson was saying about climate change.
Yeah, that's a lot. Professor Tao?
Well, I think this visit will ensure that Sino-American relations will continue to move on the right track.
Well, we certainly hope so. Well, thank you all for joining us. That was on the phone Helga Zepp LaRouche, founder of the Schiller Institute in Washington, also Mark Beeson, professor of international politics at the University of Western Australia, and in the studio Tao Wenjiao, senior research fellow of the Institute of American Studies, Chinese Academy of Social Science, and Rick Dunham of Tsinghua University. That's all the time we have for this edition of today, and I'm Brian Kopczynski, and on behalf of the rest of our team, thank you so much for joining us.